Hey, everybody. As the co-host of your Chillpack Hollywood Hour, it's always delightful to shoot the transatlantic breeze with the UK Midweek Drive team. Together, we aim to provide the best possible audio backdrop for political sanity in the 21st century. This is Phil Lairness, reporting from the middle ground between science and superstition. And you have entered the podcast zone.
Now, in an era where toxic masculinity has certainly become embedded into the curriculum, maybe we also need to consider the whole notion of toxic femininity, or possibly even toxic humanity. The key word here is obviously toxic relationships. And we're pleased now to welcome a new author to the program who's a charity worker based in the UK, author of a new book called Janus, which classical scholars will appreciate. Oh, Janus, two faces. It can be quite interesting. We're delighted to welcome, of course, the wonderful John Buchanan Nicol to the program. How are you, John?
Oh, marvelous. And thank you for a fantastic intro. Yeah, you're absolutely right. It is all about relationships. And for me, what's interesting is the macro and the micro, in the sense that what you're alluding to is toxic humanity. And for me, this odyssey has all been about an exploration of totalitarianism in general, you know, and that's how I've ended up where I am.
Well, this is, again, an extraordinary personal story, a personal life story, which I'm going to invite you to share with us in a few moments. But 3 decades of effectively having challenges within your relationship. I mean, some of those issues relating to the whole scenario seem to be astounding in so many ways. But just talk us through what was it. I mean, you must have thought at some stage, you know, is this just me? Is this the way things are? Is the Hollywood dream of living happy ever after nothing other than just a dream waiting to turn into a nightmare? What's going on here?
Well, I mean, as I just alluded to, there's the big picture and the slightly smaller one. I say that simply because, you know, I spent 30 years in dating various ladies and at the same time married. You don't actually know that you are going down the path of pathology until suddenly you wake up one day and there you are again, trapped, stuck in the same modus operandi. At the time, everyone puts their best foot forward. There is a sweet spot, a honeymoon. You know, people who groom don't lay their credentials on the line. On day one, it is a slow, incremental wearing down of somebody's reserves, somebody's ability to see through the woods into the trees. And for me personally, each time I'd enter a new relationship, I suppose, I wasn't consciously looking for more of the same. I was looking for something different. It's only after my divorce that I suddenly realized actually there was a problem with me. You know, just to flip it on its head, you know, people talk about, you know, domestic abuse and coercive relationships in abundance. But they seldom in a sense flip it on its head and say, why is it that people buy into that? Why do we in some ways tolerate it? Why don't we just leave? Why don't we just escape and evade? That's for me what Janus is.
There are 5 areas that we see here listed, which you've experienced. I mean, women who insisted that you only eat junk food for the duration of the relationship to make you overweight and ugly. Women who openly cheat on you with other men on more than 50 occasions in a 12-month period. Women who routinely mock and belittle you in front of mutual friends and work colleagues and make you disown your friends, abide by 9 p.m. curfew. And the most extraordinary one, being banned from drinking anything except water to save a few extra pounds each week on the family shopping bill. I mean, there is a line where you tend to say, look, this is not necessarily what we would regard as sensible behavior. And I'm not going to use the N word because people's definitions of normal can obviously vary in so many ways. But were there periods where you just thought, I don't know, there's something a little bit amiss with these kind of things?
Absolutely. Regularly, all the time. In fact, you know, doubting yourself, and questioning your own judgment is part and parcel of the totalitarian experience. You know, whether it's the Kims in North Korea or whether it's a partner who seeks to dominate and ultimately destroy you, it's all about belittling your own sense of self. They want to reduce you into a set of nothing but suffering and needs. At the same time, they, like any good cult leader, will therefore say, you may be inadequate in all respects. However, with me, you are something. So in isolation, to your point, in isolation, you know, and I should say each point there is a radio show in its own right. So I won't delve into each occasion where, you know, I was made to feel inadequate and insecure. But, you know, there is no doubt that, you know, the playbook of any good leader, a totalitarian figure, is about dehumanizing, devaluing those who they seek to control. And so, yes, regularly did I ruminate on the fact that I'd lost my sense of masculinity, sense of self, and the rest. Yeah, absolutely, all the time. Did I do anything about it? Not particularly, because you adapt. You self-medicate. Some people go for drugs or whatever. I drank. So, you know, there are various coping mechanisms whereby the victim, in that sense, me on this occasion, manages some sort of cognitive dissonance to rationalize what's happening. Whereas from somebody on the outside looking in, they think, well, actually, it's bonkers. But again, you know, like any cult leader, it's all about isolating you from friends and kin and the wider social group. So again, this is why I started by saying macro and micro. You know, my adventure of introspection has really left me with the feeling that in some ways to dominate a populace, dominate a society, dominate an individual, the methodologies are very much the same.
Spousal abuse is something we've covered in the past on a number of occasions. And it's fair to say, I think we are beginning to address the fact that it doesn't necessarily relate solely to gender. And I know that there will be folk who would probably be listening to this particular thing, and particularly some of your own experiences, where they're thinking, well, you know, I mean, surely you can get to a stage whereby allowing for the fact prevention is better than cure, you get a sixth sense. You get a sixth sense when effectively you're in a situation where you think this is not quite right for that for you. Or does it go deeper than that? Is there a kind of pathological area where you think actually it's all the fault of my parents or some other issue relating to the whole thing?
Well, you've hit the nail on the head. In fact, is it nature, nurture? And if it is nurture, what are those occurrences that have led me to be who I am? There is no doubt, as I explore in my prose, you know, in Janus, that I was the victim of a very, very cruel and capricious stepfather who made it his sole purpose in life to exclude me from the family unit. You know, he encouraged one thing the next day and then scolded me for it the day after that. My bedroom, for example, was nothing less than a guest room. My childhood trappings consigned to a drawer. You would never know that a child lived in the home, and so on and so forth. And this went through every aspect of my life. And therefore, you know, I, in a sense, understood love as imbalance, as being on the back foot, as uncertainty, as all of the things which would give you anything but the result of comfort. And so I carried that into my adult life. And so in a way, the type of person, the phenotype that would allow me to replicate that, unfortunately, were individuals who in their own way were addicted to conflict. You know, for them, the process was what it was about. It was, you know, issues were never there to be resolved, but in a sense to be wallowed in and exploited. It was never about outcomes, and therefore, regardless of the issue, big or small at the time, there was never a situation where a stone was ever laid over the tomb. Anything and everything was reinvigorated as a problem at any given time of their choosing. You know, it's quite a very challenging way to live. But as you actually point out, there is no doubt that the lay of the land was set very early in my existence. But the flip side, of course, is I have agency. It's a free world, and I should have jumped, but I didn't. And there's various reasons for that. But that's definitely my situation is certainly linked to my past. No doubt at all.
Do you ever encounter any of your former partners, and is there any sense of remorse or regret on their part for things that occurred, or is it simply a case of no, that's a kind of closure that might not occur for quite some time?
No, you're a great question. Absolutely not. No, never. The occasions where I have crossed the paths of ex-bos, or indeed my ex-wife, who I have loved the children to, which therefore is a regular occurrence, there is in no way at all an acknowledgement of any culpa, absolutely none whatsoever. In fact, what I've found synonymous with all the dates of serious girlfriends I've had and my wife is that for them, victim identity, in fact, is everything. It's a totem. And therefore, if you cannot break out of victim identity as a person, you cannot ever start to heal, rationalize, understand, and move on. That was one of the main problems that I've always had in my relationships, whereas I've always been portrayed as the bad wolf. In fact, when my exes would speak to other people, my name was traduced, absolutely traduced to mud. Because in order to get that sympathy from others, they needed to have the bogeyman, and the bogeyman was me. And my caricature, like all of humanity, we are a composite of great things and not so great things. But in order for that identity to stand, the worst of me was escalated into the heavens. And therefore, it became me. Not me as a person, but it became the persona that I lived. So if that makes any sense.
You mentioned, obviously, you have children. Clearly, that's an important, significant step in anybody's life experience and life journey. Have you consciously tried to protect them from this particular aspect? Are you concerned that they might read the memoir, that they might be shocked, saddened, surprised? Or is it designed very much as a kind of help guide to actually prevent people falling, and in this particular case, your children, from falling into similar challenges and experiences?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, first and foremost, it is a memoir. It is not a victim narrative. And in fact, it's told with a lot of humor, for as much humor that you can essentially veneer onto something which is such a serious subject. It started off me writing this as a bit of a vent. It then became a catharsis. It then moved on to a sort of retrospective introspection of me and all of my various life experiences that have made me what I am. But it very quickly, bizarrely enough, moved on to being a love story. So, at the same time, I was in love with all these people to a certain degree. I still am. And therefore, it is written with a chaotic hand, in the sense that that is what life is to all of us. We can't be the same thing all of the time. We're full of doubts, aspirations, guilt, fears, wants, needs, and so on and so forth. And that's why for me, Janus, the title of the book, and what it represents as the old Roman god is so apt. In a sense, he does have two faces, but he's not two-faced. In fact, what he does, if you see the depiction of him, is he looks forward and backwards. He is, in a sense, the god of beginnings and ends. He is the god of time itself. And so for me, the duplicity of nature of everybody has always been something that I've been particularly interested in. And therefore, when I wrote this book, it was about an analysis of my own duplicity, the duplicity of others. But it's all done with, I think, as much humor as possible.
If one's looking at the human experience in its broadest sense, there is a suggestion that we need to be very mindful and very careful that we do not get sucked into the illusions of relationships and the kind of narratives that certainly are predicated by the mass media in terms of the ideal relationship, whatever combination of gender that happens to be. Is this something which actually, as you continue to, I mean, are you still looking for that ideal relationship, or have you acknowledged the fact that actually, if one is appropriately coordinated, a single relationship might well be, or indeed a single individual relationship, and making peace with oneself is the first step to beginning to engage with others, to actually take that whole routine, because there's always that challenge of, I suppose you mentioned victim signaling as well from that point of view, the whole notion of poor me in this particular instance can also be applied.
Yeah, again, in a sense, that's several points in one question. I'll pull a couple apart, but I'll be brief. I mean, it's very hard to be on message and on point about any one thing at any given time. And I can only go back to my own experiences, which were that, my ex essentially defined herself through my inadequacies. I was a sounding board. I was a mood board for who she necessarily, or I should say she saw me as the hindrance to her obtaining what she saw as the utopian relationship. If only I would do one thing, if only I moved the house a bit to the left, as Basil Fawlty once asked Sybil, if only I would jump a bit higher, crouch that bit lower, and so on and so forth. If only I did one more thing, then life could be and should be okay. In fact, as a wise person once said to me, things are how they are, not how you want them to be. And I think if you take that as a starting point and you understand that life in general is about rolling with the punches, rope-a-doping at times, and not an, a utopia, which is a God-given, granted experience, then I think that you are setting yourself up for a slightly easier ride than somebody who believes and buys into the whatever it might be, mass media, Disney stereotype, and so on and so forth, of what happiness and partnership really is. The reality of it is that we're all on a scale, but it's not one scale for one thing. It's one scale for many things. And I think that, the only thing to really note here is that, you can be one or 10 on whatever particular part of life that you want to be. But, sometimes when it's abusive, when it's violent, when it's dangerous, when it's bullying in its nature, and so on and so forth, then these become a different manifestation of what a proper life should be. For me, we were outwardly solvent, outwardly happy. We had a nice house and flat in London and so on and so forth. Everything was quite pucker. If you'd said to somebody, this is my experience, they wouldn't believe it. The point I'm saying is that if somebody seeks to dominate and repress, they are in their own way master manipulators. They manipulate you, they manipulate other people, they manipulate themselves. There is no one size fits all. But my experience is that to try and live up to something which isn't necessarily real, you're always going to fall. You're always going to fall short.
Does it make you become more cynical or skeptical when it comes to a whole relationship game?
Yes, very, very cynical, very skeptical. In fact, the point to note here is for me, now that I'm in my 40s and haven't gone through this experience, I'm now in a new relationship. And to a certain degree, there's two points. The first is that I understand myself now, and therefore, for example, like an alcoholic, you manage your condition on a day-to-day basis. And there's no cure. If you have the bug, you have the bug. And for me, I have a bug, which is perhaps different to the average person, but I have it nonetheless. So I have to be aware and just be really super cautious that I don't fall into that pattern again. But at the same time, that is who I am. The one codicil to all that, of course, is the fact that in some ways I swing the other way now, because I'm super hyper vigilant of any red flags that I can recognize that I'm getting into that same state of affairs. So in some ways, it makes me less tolerant. So, you know, just because, you know, I've written a book of introspection about who I am and where I've got to and why, it doesn't mean that finding a cause is finding a cure. It, quite the opposite. In some ways, the more I discover about myself, the slightly more wary I am about the future.
You operate as a charity worker. You obviously encounter a whole range of experiences. Do you sometimes want to raise issues with your colleagues or indeed people that you work with about times when they might also believe that they're in the ideal relationship? Or sometimes do you feel it's best to keep your own counsel?
Oh, well, I keep my own counsel on all matters to do with personal lifestyle choices and so on and so forth. What I would say, for example, though, is, you know, my charity work is more in the international development arena, and therefore I have, you know, been witness to all aspects of humanity. I mean, I truly do live in a world of no shadows, and because of that, when you then come back into, you know, a country like the UK, you do bring that with you, and you become less tolerant of idiosyncrasies, which are in some ways fabricated, man-made, you know, utilized for a purpose other than what they should be. So yeah, it's a bit of a dichotomy, but I don't have the answers. That's the problem. I don't have the answers, and I don't think anyone does. That's the beauty of it, right?
And given your experiences, John, over the last 30 years, do you feel that you are comfortable in saying that you like yourself at present?
Gosh, that's on a day-to-day basis. It's hour by hour, minute by minute. Again, it's the human experience. You know, I woke up this morning quite bouncy, and then I had a couple of interactions with various individuals, and I felt quite low. You know, it's not one size fits all. I suppose what I'm trying to say is, you know, happiness for what we perceive it to be is unattainable. I mean, you know, I don't want to get too Hindu and Buddhist about it, but, you know, life is suffering. That was the realization, wasn't it? That was the enlightenment. Life is suffering. I think if you take that to be your base camp, your base premise, then anything else is a bonus in some ways. But I'm very much nowadays very conscious when things are going smoothly. Let's say, like a pilot, you know, less turbulence, but a bit of clean air. When you hit that strata of clean air, I appreciate it now in a way that I perhaps didn't a couple of years ago.
Well, there is, of course, that classic old joke about the notion that relationships were indeed a three-ring circus: the engagement ring, the wedding ring, and of course the suffering. Step away from that, perhaps. John, it's been fascinating getting an insight into your experiences. We can only wish you all the very best. How can people actually access the memoir Janus?
Well, it's available in all reputable and disreputable retailers. It's on Amazon. There's a cracking audio version, Audible, Apple. It's all in the usual places. Google Janus, John Buchanan Nicol. You know, even tweet me. Say hello. You know, it's all good.
And allowing for the fact that, as you've just said, it is all good, do you feel for yourself the future is good, or is it a case of don't be crazy? We've got climate conference coming up. It's going to be disastrous.
Well, as I say, my bread and butter is parts of the world which are tragic beyond belief. And so, I think, of course, all of the catastrophic eventualities which are ahead of us and what we're trying to do to sort them out now are pertinent. But these, with much regret, are cycles. You know, if it wasn't this, it'd be something else. So, again, it's macro, micro, right? You can only deal what's in front of you. But the big stuff matters, right?
John Buchanan Nicol, many thanks for spending some time with us today. And let's hope that future has lots less toxicity and perhaps more happiness for you.
We'd love that. We'll take it. We'll take it.
Time for another Zoomer on the Midweek Drive for Siren Radio and southsidebroadcasting.podbeam.com. Keeping the COVID-19 bugs at bay.
10 years of Stoptober yes, the official annual message to ensure that people do stop smoking, although, as we've said, you should never really start it. Certainly one of those sad aspects of the medical world that back in the 1940s, certainly folk of my parents' generation were often advised by their doctor to actually say, suffering from nerves, suffering from anxiety, have a cigarette. It'll calm all those nerves down, etc. No, it won't. And it might lead to all sorts of other challenges as well, as people are finding. And we've just had clearly, or indeed are having, a major pandemic that's clearly causing anxiety in all sorts of other areas. So we're delighted to welcome to the programme today to talk about Stoptober and more, the Tobacco Control Lead for Public Health England. It's the wonderful Martin Dockrell. How are you, Martin?
I'm very well. How are you, Alex?
I'm great. Now, 10 years, we seem to be seeing lots of good progress over those years in terms of people giving up the nicotine habit, and yet things may be taking a bit of a sideways turn now. Is it because of that line that people still believe the myth and the complete untruth that if you want to calm your nerves, have a cigarette?
Well, that's a really interesting point. So we have 2 million fewer smokers than we did when we started Stoptober. We've had 2.25 million smokers make a quit attempt with Stoptober. The idea is if you go 28 days without smoking in your first 28 days with a quit attempt, you're 5 times more likely to quit for good. So that's great. And yeah, there are lots of myths about smoking. And you were talking about some cases in the Great War, in 1914, 1918, it wasn't that great a war. When a soldier was wounded, the officer was expected to give him a cigarette while he waited for the ambulance to arrive. And now we know that's crazy, because that actually increases the heart rate and blood flow. You're right. There's this idea that it kind of helps you manage your stress, but actually the evidence is not that. The evidence is that what it actually does is it reduces the nicotine cravings from the last time. The strong evidence is that if a smoker can quit really very quickly, within a month or so, they've got reduced anxiety and depression. And over a year, that reduction is as big as if you were prescribed a dose of antidepressants, course of antidepressants, by your doctor. So it's a really good way. Quitting smoking is a really good way of reducing your anxiety and depression. It's just that first couple of days, couple of weeks of withdrawal that's really tough to get through, which is why it's so important to use nicotine replacement, either patches, gum, maybe a vape, that kind of thing. But you know, it's been a terrible 18 months, right? It's just been, I think for most of us, maybe the worst 18 months of our lives. I was struck by something that Chris Whitty, the chief medical officer, pointed out the other day. Actually, last year, more people died of smoking than died of COVID in England last year. So, we've been all locked in with our nearest and dearest. Sometimes that's been great, sometimes not so much. But it has meant that people's smoking behaviors have really changed a lot. Lots of people have quit. In fact, we've seen more people quitting with a higher success rate than, since the surveys began.
Let's just hold it there momentarily, Martin, because we're delighted to be able to welcome our ace correspondent when it comes to medical matters, because she literally is absolutely spot on, even though sometimes Zoom prevents one or two challenges just actually accessing it. Dr. Sarah Jarvis, welcome to the programme. How are you?
It's always a pleasure to be with you, Alex, and I have been tearing my hair out over Zoom, but I'm delighted to be with you finally.
No, tearing your hair out. I've been waiting for Sarah to come in to bail me out.
Oh, okay. in terms of this, Sarah, let's just go back over some of those really crucial, key, immediate benefits that people notice just from stopping smoking. Why does it give you that immediate positive feedback?
Well, I think one of the really interesting things that Martin has pointed out is this impact on mental health, because I've almost lost count of the number of patients of mine whose reason, their rationale, they genuinely believe that they cannot stop smoking because they already have lots of stresses and strains, and they find that that taking a cigarette calms them down. So I need that cigarette for my mental health. As he has so rightly said, that's just nonsense. What your body is doing is trying to get over the withdrawal effects from the drop in nicotine of your bloodstream from the last cigarette. So the mental health things, I think, from certainly as a GP, that to me is probably the single biggest barrier to people quitting. And when I can get that over to them, that actually it really is very short term. There's lots of help available from Stoptober. We know that if you stop smoking for 28 days, you're 5 times more likely to quit. And by the time you've done that, you will probably be in a position where you are less anxious, less depressed, less stressed, and you have more positive mood compared to what you were when you weren't smoking. So that to me is a real key. But of course, you're absolutely right. There's the physical side effects as well, not to mention the financial ones. I don't know if anybody's aware. I mean, even if you are, quote, only smoking the average, which is 9 cigarettes a day, which means quite a lot of people smoke less, but a lot of people smoke more. But if you're on the average, then as a man, because men on average smoke 9.2 cigarettes, you can save basically £1,900 a year. And for women, 1850. Now, given how many financial stresses people have had during COVID, that's got to be another reason for improving your mental health too. And then we get on to the physical benefits and this idea that within 20 minutes, your pulse rate starts to improve. I still remember what Martin was saying about the fact that, you know, on the front line, the first thing that the medic did would be to give you a cigarette. Of course, back in those days, it was very much the exception rather than the rule to be a non-smoker. Fortunately, we're now happily in the position where the reverse is true. But, you know, these days we're all very aware of carbon monoxide. We're aware we have carbon monoxide monitors in our home. We know that carbon monoxide is potentially deadly. We know that you need to get your boiler serviced. You need to get your gas fire serviced. You must never go to sleep in a tent with a barbecue fire inside it because of the potential deadly effects of carbon monoxide. And yet every time you smoke, you're voluntarily breathing it in. And within 8 hours, your levels have halved. Within 2 days, you've got rid of all that excess carbon monoxide from your body. Now, our smoking cessation advisor uses a carbon monoxide monitor at the practice. And they say that, you know, from their perspective, if you really want, you know, the point, the whole thing about smoking is it's instant gratification. Actually, this is almost instant gratification in terms of, wow, look how much good I'm doing myself. So it really is fantastic. You know, 3 days, your bronchial tubes start to relax. 3 to 9 months, you might get more coughing in the short term. But the point I always make to my patients is that's because basically the little cilia, which are the little sort of waggly tails on the cells inside your cell, inside your lungs, which are supposed to be helping you get rid of all that gunk, they're choked. Basically, they are being completely smothered with tar. And once you've stopped smoking, they start to come to life. But within 3 to 9 months, your breathing can improve, your lung function increases by up to 10%. And that means that coughs, wheezing, breathing all improve. Fast forward to a year and half the risk of heart attack that you had if you smoked.
So, Sarah, I found when I quit smoking some time ago. that what happened quite quickly, oh, I tell you, it was 20 years ago, about the time many of our listeners were just going to school for the first time. But I quit smoking. But immediately I began, my running improved, the performance of the gym improved. You could see that day by day. And the real key was my swimming improved, because I was able to swim kind of a length of the pool pretty much on a single breath. Well, I'd been struggling to run for a bus a month or two before that. So it really makes a big difference really quickly.
And actually, I think that's really important, given that very, very sadly, what we are seeing is that more and more younger people are smoking. And, you know, we know they've had a really hard time during the pandemic. 24%, nearly 1 in 4 18 to 24 year olds smoke, compared to just 1 in 11 people over the age of 60. But the point about young people is that when I talk to them again, they'll say, oh, well, I've got time to stop smoking. You know, listen, if I thought, you keep telling me about the benefits of stopping smoking, so, you know, actually, if I stop when I'm 40, well, quite frankly, you know, if I'm 40, I might as well be dead. I'll be so old. But if I stop smoking, then it'll all be fine by the time I get to be really old. Well, yeah, but what about the gym? What about being able to run? Young people are really fitness conscious. Many of them are really fitness conscious. And I just find it extraordinary that those same young people who are worrying about their performance at the gym and who may even be considering, you know, taking illegal steroids to boost their performance are smoking. Because actually, if you really want to get better, don't smoke.
Well, so I was kind of worried about putting on the pounds, which is part of the reason that I got out of my bike and joined the gym and started going back to the swimming more regularly. But, you know, I found that combination of giving up smoking and getting better exercise, more fresh air, that just did my sense of well-being just the power of good. Much less anxious, much less depressed. And, you know, smoking, I knew every time I inhaled a cigarette, it wasn't really helping me with my, you know, the situation I was in. But getting out and having a walk by the sea with the dog and a mate, that is something special.
Martin, it may well be Stoptober, but as I've frequently said, we should never really start. I've been looking back over some comic books from the 1960s, actually, for one of the modules I take at the University of Lincoln, and they had adverts there in terms of how you can actually save up for a bike with just stopping your cigarettes, basically. It's quite extraordinary. The message is still out there. Hopefully it's going to be improving, and it will get back on track in terms of we'll see in the 21st century people don't smoke, don't even start. Don't stop, then you don't have to start, etc. Sarah, where can people go to find out further information about help and assistance?
So much help and assistance available there. Everything, whether it's, you know, joining an online community of like-minded people, whether it's a Facebook page, a messenger bot, daily emails, daily SMS, a personal quit tool, you can find them all from one place. And Martin and I are going to say it together. Search Stoptober.
I'm very impressed. I mean, I can see, obviously, Sarah, there's a whole new sort of area here with Jarvis and Dockrell working together for a whole range of factors.
Yeah, so, looking forward to that.
Yeah, brilliant stuff. Sarah, it's a delight as ever to feature your good self. And a reasonably interesting Zoomer for yourself once you manage to get on?
Of course. So, you know, the stress of getting on was made all the greater because I always enjoy talking to you so much, Alex.
So I take it you will return. And likewise, Martin, has it been okay for yourself?
Oh, it's been great. And I can't wait to come back. Maybe we'll do it all again. Oh, in New Year. How about New Year's Eve? We'll have a little New Year's Eve party.
Yeah, well, that could prove interesting. Okay, Dr. Sarah Jarvis and Martin Dockrell, of course, from Public Health England. Many thanks indeed. Keep on keeping on and keep healthy.
Thanks, Alex.
So eyesight, it's such a precious and vital part of our whole human experience. And yet we are certainly in a situation whereby more and more of us are needing to actually spend copious amounts of time staring at a screen and indeed not noticing that maybe our eyesight is just not necessarily what it once used to be, especially with things such as dry eye disease around the whole system. To talk us through some of the key aspects with respect to eyesight and indeed best eye health, we're delighted to welcome optometrist Sarah Farrance to the programme. Sarah, how are you?
Very well, thank you, Alex.
Now, here we are, as say, having an audio interview, obviously, but we're using the computer medium, we're looking at screens, we're addressing asset issues relating to that. And this is something that certainly over the last 18 months, more and more of us have been doing without necessarily taking the best screen hygiene or indeed eye care or eye hygiene to protect our eyes. Is that right?
Certainly, from new figures released today from eye experts TAYA, we found that a fifth of UK adults are actually reporting that their eye health has deteriorated over the last 18 months of the pandemic. And we know from this same study that only about 9% of people are sort of actively looking after their eyes. And what we mean by that is actually sort of taking regular breaks when they're staring at screens all day, making sure that they are having regular eye examinations and responding to symptoms if they feel that their eyes are dry and, you know, actually, you know, taking the care to do something about it.
One in eight of us have been reporting uncomfortable eyes, and that obviously leads to one in seven of the population suffering with dry eye disease. Can you just explain what dry eye disease actually is? Is it just a case of that itchy feeling that you get, or literally not producing sufficient fluids to keep, obviously, the vitreous humour and so on in force?
So Alex, dry disease is a bit of an umbrella term, a bit like saying someone has a heart condition. And what it really means is that either the quality or the quantity of the tears that protect our eyes are affected in some way. And if you think about it, the tears are a vertical body of water that the body is able to maintain. So it's pretty clever stuff. And the problem is, once the balance goes wrong in some way, then the tears aren't performing their function of protecting the eyes and lubricating the eyes and keeping the eyes comfortable. And so once you have a dry eye problem, it's difficult to regain that balance. And that can often be the issue, that you sort of go round in a bit of a vicious cycle where you wake up each day, you do your work, you stare at a screen, your eyes get more and more dry, and it's quite hard to break that cycle. Certainly there are lots of things you can do to help. There's a really top tip called the 20-20-20 rule, nice simple one to remember. And what that means is, when you're using a screen in particular, making sure every 20 minutes you're looking away across the room about 20 feet and you're doing that for about 20 seconds. So it's a simple one, but a really effective one at just helping to break the sort of staring cycle when you're using a computer. The other thing you can actively do if your eyes do feel a bit dry and a bit stingy is use a preservative-free dry eye drop, lubricant drop. They can really help just to rehydrate the eye surface and to make the eyes feel sort of instantly a lot more comfortable and just get the balance of the tears back a little bit.
Just as we've spoken in previous sessions about the importance of regular dental checks and so on, clearly having regular eye checks also important. And yet the pandemic presumably has also had a bit of an impact in people feeling comfortable going to their local optometrist, or indeed an optometrist, to actually have their regular twice or biannual eye checks out, basically.
Yeah, so the figures released also found that two-thirds of people were actually keeping up with their regular eye exams. And certainly during the pandemic, obviously, like many aspects of healthcare, that has shifted the timescales have kind of collapsed a little bit. Certainly from a point of view of care available, optometrists have been sort of out in force during the pandemic, looking after people's eyes. And it's still really important. I think a lot of people assume that if they had a problem with their eyesight or indeed their eyes, they would know, they would tell, they would look across the garden and see a problem. But the problem is that there are quite a number of reasonably common conditions where you don't know and you don't realize and you don't get symptoms. And so that's the reason why we encourage people to try and keep up a regular pattern with having their eyes examined at least every couple of years or so.
And in terms of, I would say, the other things that might be preventing people from actually going to their opticians and so on, is it just a case of a general phobia? Is there a concern about the whole eye process? And is there anything you can say, Sarah, that can actually assuage those fears and say it's okay, all will be well?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting that there have been studies that have shown that the general public fear going to the optometrist more than going to their dentist. Because I think the thing is, people value their eyesight an awful lot. And so people can be a bit head in the sand if they worry that something is going on. They think, oh, I don't want to know, you know, if there's a problem. But the thing is about eye exams in this day and age, that they are nice and simple. It can always feel like a bit of a test, you know, when you're being sort of quizzed for all these answers, you know, can you see better with this one or that one? You can feel a bit anxious about it. But it's always just about getting the answers that we need about how healthy your eyes are and how well you're seeing. And optometrists are always very aware of that level of anxiety that some patients can feel. And with that in mind, we often do adapt the way we might test a person's eyes to make sure we can accommodate them and make them feel relaxed.
And if people wish to find out further details about the TEA data and survey, where would you suggest they should actually go?
Yeah, so we have a website, which is youreyehealth.co.uk, which has lots of information and a symptom checker as well to find out if you may have things like dry eye problems.
And Sarah, I noticed that you represent the UK as an ambassador for the Tear Film and Ocular Surface Society. So certainly from that point of view, in terms of the international sort of area, do you feel as though actually we do quite well in Britain in terms of regular eye tests, or is it just a case of, well, we can always do better?
Well, I mean, both, you know, yes, I think we do well in Britain generally, despite the numbers being relatively low. Obviously, we could always do a lot better, and it would be nice to see more people taking better care of their eye health in general. But when you look at it from a global perspective and you look at the problems that you see in, you know, countries that aren't quite as developed and have such good health systems of ours, then obviously they have much bigger issues than we do.
Sarah, it's been fascinating getting an insight into best eye health. Again, just a reminder, especially the 20-20-20 rule, look away at something 20 metres away for 20 seconds every 20 minutes. Just a minor point. Can you say 20 metres or does it have to be 20 feet? I'm just worried about the sort of the detail here. Minor point.
I think it is a very minor point, Alex. It's just really the point of looking across, you know, away from the screen, you know. So whether your room is 2 metres big or, you know, 20 feet big or 20 metres big, it's just the process of not continuing to stare at that screen. So you're just sort of glancing out the window or looking across the room.
As I said, optometrist Sarah Farrant, huge thanks. And may your eye health always be 100%.
Thanks, Alex.
So will it be good COP26 or bad COP26? We're certainly having the lead in to the climate change scenario. And in the run up to COP26 in November, there's still an awful lot of concern about the future of local green spaces and nature spots. And to talk us through this particular aspect, we're delighted to welcome from the RSPB, of course, members of the Climate Coalition, the fabulous Sarah Whitebread. How are you, Sarah?
Hello there, Alex. Hi, yeah, very well, thank you. Nice to hear you.
Excellent. So, I mean, a lot of people are quite concerned that green areas, local green areas in particular, could completely disappear in future. I mean, is that something which clearly is going to have an impact on people's mental health, well-being and so on? Is it just a case of, well, that's the inevitable sign of progress in the 21st century?
Well, people are really concerned about it, and we know that, you know, particularly over the last 18 months, the difficult times that we've been having, we know that 86% of people are now saying that they're turning to their local parks and green spaces as places to really boost their mental health and their well-being. And over half of people are saying actually that through lockdown they've appreciated nature more. Just at the RSPB this year, we had our biggest ever Big Garden Bird Watch, over 1 million people taking part in January. So I think it is really true that there's this rising appreciation, interest and care for nature, and also a real concern about what the future could hold with the climate crisis if we don't take big action now to make a difference.
I mean, this is the point, of course, and we get an awful lot of rhetoric coming out of the government and various officers from the Prime Minister onwards about, oh, of course, this is all good and so on. But are we actually faced with this situation whereby action does need to be taken now to ensure that, you know, legislation is put in place to protect those local green areas?
Yeah, definitely. It's really, really important. You know, this is the decade where we have to see action, both for the climate crisis and the nature crisis. If we don't turn things around in this decade, then we're really, really in trouble. And that applies to our local green spaces as well as larger national parks. You know, we're calling for 30% of land and 30% of sea to be protected by 2030 for nature. And that includes, yeah, our local spaces as well, because it's really important for people near where they live to be able to connect with nature and to be able to get out and enjoy the clean air and the green space for their health and their well-being.
We're in the middle of Great Big Green Week. And again, that's a celebration of climate action. Over 2,500 community events and festivals are being held in communities across the country. Does that actually help not only raise the awareness, but actually engage people with the notion of ensuring that going green, to use that cliched phrase, is not hugely difficult, but it is very important?
Definitely. That's really, really what we're trying to do. You know, Great Big Green Week is all about bringing people together to have some fun, but also to share a really important message that we can go green. There's all sorts of things that you can do in your home, in your garden, in your local community, to get involved, to make a change in your life. And also to send a message to the government, you know, that we're doing all this stuff and we're up for it and we need them to take a lead as well. So, yeah, I definitely recommend people check out the website greatbiggreenweek.com and have a look for local events near you, because there's all sorts of stuff going on across the country and people can get involved.
There are a number of issues relating to, obviously, Extinction Rebellion and so on, and people have different views about how effective the strategies are, and indeed how perhaps possibly problematic their messages can actually be in terms of obviously getting people on side. The Royal Society for the Protection of Birds is obviously something which I think most people would actually say, we appreciate this, we appreciate the excellent work that you're actually doing. But building up that whole notion of the fight that unites and the way in which you're kind of obviously building in coalitions and lines within that, do you think that there are any challenges that people will have to deal with in terms of saying, well, I like the Royal Society for the Protection of Birds until they started going all climate on me?
Well, I think we're taking this action, you know, because we are seeing how serious the climate crisis is, both for people but also for our wildlife. We're seeing the impacts of climate change on bird species here in the UK. I mean, take puffins, for example. You know, we're seeing declining numbers of puffins, and we think a big part of the reason for that is the sand eels that they feed on are reducing in number because the oceans are warming, and so the habitat for the sand eel isn't as good as it used to be, and that's causing impact on our seabirds. So, you know, all of these environmental issues are connected. And at the RSPB, we're really keen to follow the science, look at what's happening to our wildlife and how we can make a difference. And the climate crisis is a really pressing issue in that. And so we absolutely see it as a priority for us to be taking action on this.
As we said earlier, the pandemic has had an interesting impact insofar as 51% of people say that the lockdowns have made them appreciate nature more. There is a sense that actually, well, we should be going back to the office now, we should put all that behind us. How do we actually keep that important sort of reflection on nature very much to the fore when you might be sort of back into the, some might say, drudgery of the 9-to-5 office commute and so on and so forth?
I think it's about finding that balance, isn't it? And you're just holding on to what you've enjoyed in nature through that lockdown time and trying to carry that over maybe into more of a sort of back to, you know, how it was before existence. I mean, there are certain changes people will have made, maybe getting out for a walk more in the day, maybe appreciating the birds in their garden more, that you can carry over into your life now. And I think that's a really important thing to do because it does have a big boost for your well-being and a big difference in how you look at life, I think, if you appreciate nature more. So I'm sure there are ways that people can carry that through.
And does rewilding help? I mean, the sense of actually sometimes allowing certain areas of land to actually become more wild and be less cultivated. I mean, I noticed at the University of Lincoln, there are certain areas of land that have been specifically set aside to just sort of rewild and allow it to develop in their own way. Does that actually assist in terms of bird populations as well?
It can do, yeah. It's certainly one of the things we need to look at. You know, there's a range of different things, from a rewilding approach where you kind of leave nature to do its thing, to a more managed approach where you intervene in certain ways to encourage certain species. We need to kind of use all these tools in the toolkit to encourage nature to come back and thrive, because it really is a crisis point now.
Okay, well, hopefully, as I say, we'll speak as things continue to improve, because crisis point always sort of tends to sort of raise up the stress values from that point of view. Can you share with us some of the websites and the best place to actually go to follow not only Great Big Green Week, but also the RSPB and other factors as well?
Yeah, of course. So it's greatbiggreenweek.com. It's the place to go to find all the information about Great Big Green Week. And if you're looking on social media, if you look for that or the hashtag The Fight That Unites, and similarly, rspb.org.uk is our website where you can find out all about the stuff that we're doing on this. And if you use the hashtag MyClimateAction for any action you're taking.
And I've got to ask the question, Sarah, do you have any particular birds that you always would turn around and say, yes, actually, I always go for that? I mean, you mentioned the puffin, etc. I mean, is it the starling? Is it the swift? Is it the swallow? Is it the pigeon? You know, any particular bird which you think, yeah, that's my favourite?
Well, I love a puffin. That was my dad's favourite. But actually, my favourite bird is the goldcrest. It has a little streak of yellow right across the centre of its head, like a kind of mohawk or something. And I just think it looks really like it's got attitude, and it's a funky little bird. That's my favourite.
Fantastic. So, Sarah Whitebread from the RSPB, huge thanks. And continue enjoying the green worlds.
Thank you very much, Alex. Thanks.
Each day to the steps of St. Paul's, the little old bird woman comes in her own bags full of crumbs. Come feed the little bird, show them you care, and you'll be glad if you do. Their young ones are hungry, their nests are so bare, all it takes is tuppence from you. The birds, tuppence a bag, tuppence, tuppence, tuppence a bag. Feed the birds, that's what she cries, while overhead her birds fill the skies. All around the cathedral, saints and apostles look down as she sells her wares. Although you can't see it, you know they are smiling each time someone shows that he cares. Though her words are simple, listen, listen, she's calling to you. Feed the birds, tuppence a bag, tuppence, tuppence, tuppence a bag. She's calling to you. Feed the birds, tuppence a bag, tuppence, tuppence, tuppence a bag.